From WNPR, I'm John Dankosky, and this is The Wheelhouse.
We just got back from the Middle East. We just got back to Saudi Arabia.
There was not a single hint of a protester anywhere there during the whole time we were there. Not one guy with a bad placard.
I encountered and am aware of information and intelligence that revealed contacts and interactions between Russian officials and U.S. persons involved in the Trump campaign.
The president's budget always gets rewritten by the Congress, so it's important to consider it not as the last word, but as a starting point, a statement.
UK police in Manchester say they've arrested three more people in connection with Monday night's bombing at a concert venue, in addition to one person already in custody. The bombing killed 22 people and injured more than 60 others.
And we'll start our conversation there. You can join us 860-275-7266. Comment on our website, WNPR.org/The Wheelhouse. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at WNPR Wheelhouse. We're joined as always by Colin McEnroe, host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Hello, Colin.
Good morning, Mr. Dankosky.
Mark Pazniokas is here. He's Capital Bureau Chief at the Connecticut Mirror. Hello, Paz.
Good morning.
And Suzanne Bates, Policy Director at the Yankee Institute for Public Policy. Hello there, Suzanne.
Good morning.
As we just heard, the death toll 22 with more than 60 injuries. Injured many seriously, and many of the injured and dead children at a bombing Monday at an Ariana Grande concert in Manchester, England. Here's U.S. President Donald Trump, who was abroad, commenting on the attackers.
So many young, beautiful, innocent people living and enjoying their lives murdered by evil losers in life. I won't call them monsters, because they would like that term. They would think that's a great name. I will call them, from now on, losers, because that's what they are. They're losers. And we'll have more of them. But they're losers. Just remember that.
That's President Trump reacting to the Manchester bombing. A lot more news has come out in just the last day or so about details about the bomber, about potential ISIS involvement. I guess I'm wondering, Colin, the first thing we all think about is when we see an attack like this, we think about the ability for ISIS to inspire people to create attacks like this in all sorts of places that we wouldn't expect them. This is the first of its kind in quite some time, but it's coming at a time where there's a lot going on around the world, including Donald Trump's visit overseas. What exactly do you have to say about the aftermath of this right now with everything else going on in the world?
Yeah, I'm not sure that I have a lot that's profound to say, and it's a little bit early because the number of things we don't know, what Donald Trump would say, the known unknowns, exceeds the things that we do know. But it does look as though this is the work of maybe some kind of cell. One thing that you can generally say, I mean, we're all becoming kind of experts on things like this, whether we want to or not, as opposed to something like Nice. I mean, first of all, Europe has turned into kind of a theater for this kind of stuff in a very unpleasant way, whether it's Nice or Brussels or Paris and a whole bunch of other maybe less publicized ones. There's increasingly a lot of activity in Europe. Bombs are hard to make. Bombs at work are really hard to make. It's very hard for one person without a tremendous amount of training to make a bomb that works. This is a bomb that worked. Chances are there were a number of people who did work on this. You just heard about the multiple arrests. I guess the one thing that I would first of all, it's disturbing. The next thing we probably want to know is to what degree are these self-radicalized kind of open source terrorists, or to what degree were they taking instructions from ISIS? My guess is that they'll turn out to be the former rather than the latter. But I mean, that's just a guess. We don't really know these kinds of things yet. One thing that I will just add to this is that, and this is increasingly a problem, American intelligence leaked the name of Salman Abdi before British police were ready to do that. That's not a small thing. It means that, for example, they couldn't do a sort of subtle investigation of his house and his neighborhood because, I mean, if you heard all things considered last night, I mean, they had a correspondent right out there who they were saying, well, what do you see right now? Have you talked to the neighbors and all this kind of stuff? So this is a very leaky administration we have right now. They're just sort of, it's sort of all over the intelligence and law enforcement community right now. There's just a culture of leaking. This is a kind of leaking that I think, is a little bit disturbing. I mean, it affects our relationships with other intelligence communities as well. So that's, you know, a little discipline might be needed at this point.
And this comes on the heels, Paz, of the president supposedly leaking some information during a visit with Russian diplomats, information that was gathered by, at the time we heard, a Middle East ally we later learn is Israel, which then he went and visited. The type of discipline that Colin's talking about in a very, very dangerous world may be something that the American government needs to be taking seriously.
The leaks are disturbing because some of the previous leaks have been really aimed at exposing policy flaws and dissension in the U.S. government, and that's far different than revealing assets or revealing how certain intelligence may have come to the fore. Obviously, the concern, I think, in the U.S. is to what extent will this inspire anything here? You know, most of the more recent incidents, people have felt they were people inspired by ISIS, but were not under direct control, you know, which is cold comfort to anybody who's the victim of one of these attacks. But there is a significant difference about the extent to which there's command and control by ISIS over activities in the U.S. and in Europe.
And of course, the idea of terrorism, Suzanne, is something we've been living with for quite some time. But as Colin suggests, it is playing out slightly differently in Europe than here in the United States. There's a very high terror threat level in England right now. Europe has been on alert for quite some time. Is there an American way, perhaps, of looking at this threat versus a European way where the problem seems so much more at their doorstep on a day-to-day basis?
Well, right. I mean, it really hasn't been that long since the last attack. If you think about the lone truck driver who drove over a bunch of tourists on the bridge in London, there is this sort of steady drumbeat of these kind of lone wolf activities. It's, you know, there's an election going on, too, in England right now. And so you wonder, is that going to attract more of these types of activities? And then you worry what that does to a fairly stable democracy, you know, over time. Even though there aren't that many people who are affected by these attacks, it's the fear. You know, it's the fear of the other. It's the fear of being out in public. I think it does a lot to destabilize society when you see these kinds of attacks.
We have this destabilized society in Europe, Colin. We also have the president right now in Europe visiting with the Pope today in Rome. He's been on the road in Saudi Arabia, in the Middle East, as he said in their earlier clip, and then went on to Israel from there. This all happening at a time of President Trump's first trip abroad. What are you seeing in this trip abroad as you look at the president go about?
Well, I mean, I think there's sort of two ways to play it and two ways to interpret it. And you know, you will read commentary from conservatives that's not entirely unpersuasive, saying, well, this is a good moment for him in the sense that he is forcefully speaking about an actual problem, a problem that's real, a problem that reared its head, in Manchester right at the time that he's touring around talking about it. So this is an opportunity for him to be presidential and say presidential things. There are other ways in which he has during this trip appeared to be either in over his head or not entirely equipped to either speak meaningfully or communicate meaningfully or write meaningfully in guest books at museums. I don't know. It's an inconclusive trip. I will be interested to see what the next few days hold. Usually when you talk to the Pope, you don't talk to the Pope in a very public way. My guess is that the Pope would like to grind Trump pretty hard about the Paris Climate Accords and about immigration. I think also that Pope will also be very interested. I mean, if you go back to Trump's speech in Riyadh, one of the things he says is basically early in the speech, he says, America's a sovereign nation. So when we consider our own interests first. That will always come first. That will precede everything else. and then blah, blah, blah. And that's sort of the antithesis of the message of Pope Francis, right? That you've got to stop thinking of yourself as sovereign nations, that humanity is all fundamentally interconnected, that we're all in this together. We're on this terrifying global climate adventure together. We are addressing issues of socioeconomic injustice together, that we are globally linked whether we like it or not. And that's sort of the antithesis of Donald Trump's message, which is very much America first, America great again. To whatever extent we're globally linked, that's often a drain on America's resources and energy. We ought to be less globally linked. So, who knows? I don't know whether Pope Francis has an interest in having an aggressive conversation with him about that, but that certainly will be on his mind.
For a president who is as inward-looking as Donald Trump has been, I don't think you can underestimate the potential upside of this trip for him early in his administration. This is a president who, by all accounts, is influenced by face-to-face contact. This is not somebody who devours briefing books. So, I think this is probably a huge positive for the U.S. and the world to have him face-to-face, in several countries over 9 days.
And to Colin's point, Suzanne, this idea of an inward-looking foreign policy versus an outward-looking foreign policy, it does change your perspective on the world when you go elsewhere in the world and you meet with people who live in some cases, lead very different societies than ours.
Right. And I think, the point, Donald Trump was not a career politician. He really hasn't taken these trips like so many even junior-level politicians have. So this is kind of a first foray for him in learning about the world in a way that, businessmen probably don't get the same perspective. So I think it is a positive thing will be a positive thing for his foreign policy.
Can I say the thing that's not positive? This has really been on my mind a lot. This is a serious concern that I have. You can look at it in terms of optics, the now infamous picture of the orb. Well, the other two people holding the orb are King Salman and al-Sisi from Egypt. These are ruthless, brutal dictators. We just played a clip of Wilbur Ross, the Commerce Secretary, marveling happily at the fact that there were no protesters, no demonstrators. This was so great. We visited Saudi Arabia, and there weren't all these horrible demonstrators all over the place. And the person interviewing him says, that might be due to significant restrictions on people's ability to dissent here. He goes, that's his response. Maybe it's not that. Well, no, it is that. Saudi Arabia has as little domestic freedom as it is possible to have. Saudi Arabia is a ruthless dictatorship which combines the elements of a powerful punishing theocracy with basic grinding totalitarian control. You go to jail for political dissent. There are no opposition parties in Saudi Arabia. And what concerns me about Donald Trump, and this will sound like a little bit of an exaggeration, but I look at the people that he seems to enjoy being with. He seems to enjoy being with those two guys. He likes Putin. He talks about how Putin can really run his country. He likes Duterte. He likes Erdogan. And maybe likes him a little less after the fracas in Washington. I don't know. These are all ruthless tyrants. He does not have a comparable group of friends among democratically elected world leaders. Maybe at the G7s and the stuff that he's going to now, he'll make some friends. But, his encounter with Merkel was incredibly awkward, and that worries me. It worries me that he likes military dictators so much.
He and Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau seem to be fast friends. So there's one bright spot. But, I agree that that's concerning, especially, Putin. But he's certainly not the first American president to go abroad and spend time with ruthless dictators, right? That's kind of something you have to do.
If he liked a lot of other people, I would be a little less concerned.
Well, they don't like him very much. I think it's a mutual, it's a hard thing to like someone when they don't like you.
And when he does use these phrases like how Putin can really run his country. Well, Putin is able to really run his country by suspending every single democratic freedom that we are attached to in this country. It makes me, I can't help but be made nervous.
But before I move too far from this foreign policy thing, I will just say that, there's some news this morning that I read on the AP and now in Reuters. And as we mourn those who are killed in the Manchester bombing. And there are ties, clearly, it seems, to the destabilized country of Libya, to that bomber. I'm reading this morning that at least 34 migrants, most of them toddlers, drowned on Wednesday as Coast Guard boats and other vessels tried to save hundreds of others packed into boats off the coast of Libya. One group of boats listed suddenly, sending 200 people tumbling into the Mediterranean, according to Italian Coast Guard. So we have a lot of stories tied together, and many of them are tied to some of the exact same problems. But I think we should also take a moment for those killed trying to flee Libya this morning as well. As we turn maybe to something a little bit more on the domestic front with Donald Trump, Colin, this past week has been kind of interesting because we're used to a different sort of news cycle in which something happens and then maybe it lasts for a couple days and then we get a chance to talk about it next week or disseminate some information or learn a little bit about it. But you've listed about 8 things that happened since the last time we got together on Wednesday, all having to do somewhere with Donald Trump and the Russia investigation.
Right. So, I mean, even since you and I got off the air at 1 o'clock on Wednesday, I think the news that Joe Lieberman might be the next director of the FBI broke. I think that idea is pretty well dead right now. If it wasn't dead, but prior to this morning, the fact that that one of his law partners or one of the principals of the law firm that he works in has now been hired as outside counsel by Donald Trump, that would probably put the last nail in it. But I also think there was a lot of pushback from the Democrats in the Senate. And probably from the professionals in the FBI. I think the special counsel Mueller announcement came out also after we got off the air. And since then, yeah, just to run through a few of them, the New York Times reported on the so-called nut job remark that Trump made about Comey to the Russians visiting him, that he needed to get rid of this nut job, and he's now relieved. The Washington Post reported that a current senior White House advisor is a significant person of interest in the FBI investigation into potential Trump campaign collusions with Russia. There seems to be a consensus. I don't know whether it's fair or not. That it might very well be Jared Kushner. The Washington Post also then reported that at some point before the firing of Comey, senior White House officials sounded out the two top intelligence officials, or two of the top intelligence officials, about the possibility of intervening with Comey. This would be Coates and Rogers. There was an exchange yesterday with Coates in the intelligence community where he was pressed by Blumenthal about this and not too many answers. Also, the one thing that I would just mention that I think is also, well, Mike Flynn took the Fifth Amendment when subpoenaed by the Senate Intelligence Committee. Not even clear whether he can do that, particularly when they're going after his business records. Here's one that kind of got swept under a little bit by all the activity yesterday. So former CIA Director John Brennan was also testified in front of the Intelligence Committee on Tuesday. What Brennan said is that Russia, quote, brazenly interfered, unquote, in the 2016 elections. He had been in active contact with members of the Trump campaign. He didn't say colluded. He just said active contact. And then he said, and this was kind of a stunning quote, he said, frequently people who go along a treasonous path do not know they are on a treasonous path until it is too late. And I don't know that he necessarily meant textbook definition of treason, which is the only crime defined in the Constitution. This is probably not treason. It's a rather strong statement for a former CIA director.
Treasonous path is. And I don't know, Paz, last week, you know, as we were considering some of these things, many of the questions were how much like Watergate is this? And then you start to read down that list and you think about the entanglements with Russia and the foreign policy implications, as Suzanne was just saying, with Russia. And you think about the foreign policy implications with Israel. And this increasingly doesn't feel like Watergate. It's Watergate in the sense of the number of things that we're finding out about potential misdeeds. But they seem to have more consequences than a burglary and a cover-up.
Well, and of course, Watergate was about far more than a burglary and a cover-up. It was using U.S. intelligence, U.S. law enforcement, and the IRS to kind of subvert democracy. So there was that. But the echo...
So there's that.
The echo of Watergate in what Colin just recited, though, the thing that jumps out is trying to use the intelligence community to back the FBI off, because that was one of Nixon's ploys, get the goddamn FBI to back down, get the CIA to quash this thing and quash it now. So I will admit, I'm trying to resist the Watergate comparisons, But that one sent something of a chill down my back.
Mm. Suzanne, your reaction to some of the news of the week?
So I think I have a few reactions. So I'm glad Robert Mueller was asked to be the special counsel. I'm hoping we'll get to the bottom. Part of my concern is I think for many people, especially Trump supporters, of whom there are still many, what they see is a media that has already impeached President Trump in their minds, right? And this Harvard study that came out this week that said 93% of the coverage on CNN and NBC has been negative about President Trump. It feels like we've already condemned him as guilty, and now we're just trying to figure out what's our best pathway to call him guilty. I'm still not convinced, you know, was this bumbling by, you know, people who were political amateurs, or was this like a, you know, a serious collusion or...
But I think the question, though, comes in like when Colin reads the statement by former CIA Director Brennan, that's not the media deciding that Brennan is saying something that's not that interesting and they want to make it more interesting. That's actually him saying that he believes that there's a treasonous, a treacherous path. I mean, I don't know what to make about that. That's not a media fabrication.
No, absolutely not. No. And all of that needs to be reported. And I think this issue needs to be reported. It's that... I mean, really, when you listen to a lot of reporters, they have found him guilty in their minds and want to impeach him, you know, and they're kind of trying to find a pathway to get there. And I think, too, I mean, if I can just pivot for a second, because there's this other big story going on. Lois Lerner is up in, you know, it's part of a court battle right now in Ohio, talking about all of the things that she did at the IRS. No one was ever fired from the IRS for targeting hundreds of conservative organizations with a government agency. You know, here's this court case going on that no one's really paying any attention to except for conservative media. And I think when again, those Trump supporters who feel like the media is already very biased see this dichotomy, it's disturbing to them. And I think rightfully so.
Mm. The one area in which I am sympathetic to that view is the speculation that was mainly been opinion writers, but the speculation about using the 25th Amendment that somehow President Trump would be removed by a vote of the cabinet and the vice president. Let's just stop that. Mm-hmm. That is not going to happen. You know, if there is a finding that the president during his campaign or there was an effort to cover things up once he took office, if there's evidence of that, that needs to be explored through, and I'm not saying it's there, an impeachment process. Just stop this talk of that in essence there would be a constitutional coup to remove the president of the United States. This country would go crazy. It's fun. Been fun thing for opinion writers to roll around in, but just stop it.
Right. I mean, first of all, the 25th Amendment is not intended to be used that way. Right. 25th Amendment is really about incapacitation, which is
Charles Krauthammer wrote. It's not if you're stupid; it's in case you had a stroke.
Right.
You know?
I mean, you know, every time that Donald Trump is able to execute some aspect of his office if you get up in Riyadh and give a speech and, you know, not make too many mistakes and stuff like that, that's basically every time he does something like that, he takes the 25th Amendment further off the table. I don't think that's a realistic avenue of speculation right now. I will say two quick things really quickly. In terms of impeachment, one thing that we have to admit as an American society is there are two versions of impeachment in America. One of them, the majorities in Congress are the opposite of the president's political party, and in the other, they're the same. And those are just two different standards of impeachment. Impeachment is a political process fundamentally. I would say that, you know, I mean, maybe another shoe or two needs to drop. But we're pretty close to the standard where if the opposite party's in control, you start thinking about impaneling. You know, I mean, really, really are pretty the level of dysfunction here. And, yeah, the press coverage has been very negative. But, you know, I mean, basically, in a very short time, this man has fired his own NSA director, the acting attorney general, and the director of the FBI. This just doesn't happen. Now, the press didn't do any of those things. You know, I mean, he did those things. And you know, this is all happening in the context, of a protracted investigation into unprecedented levels of meddling in a domestic election by a foreign power. I do think, you know, maybe the press is too negative, but the press would be irresponsible if they didn't take all this stuff very seriously.
Last 30 seconds. Go ahead.
Well, so but President Trump is not the is not a normal president. I mean, yes, this first 100 whatever days we're into now has been very abnormal, but he's not a normal guy. And let's face it, the Americans didn't elect him expecting a normal guy. His unlikability was like off the charts before he was elected, and yet he was still elected. So I think when you're impeaching him already, you know, it's too early, and it's really disrespectful to the voters that just put him into office.
Well, let's take a break. When we come back, let's talk a little bit about budgets, both here at the state level and also the budget that the Trump administration just put out with Suzanne Bates, policy director of the Yankee Institute for Public Policy, our own Colin McEnroe from the Colin McEnroe Show, and Mark Pazniokas, Capitol Bureau Chief at the Connecticut Mirror. This is The Wheelhouse. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Tankosky. We're talking about the week's news with Suzanne Bates, policy director of the Yankee Institute for Public Policy. We have great conversations during the breaks. Mark Pazniokas is Capitol Bureau Chief at the Connecticut Mirror. And also our own Colin McEnroe, who has a show every day on WNPR. It's at 1 o'clock in the afternoon. Colin, what is your program today?
Oh, we are actually doing a show about cannibalism. I'll just quickly say that Josh Nalea, who's produces these kinds of shows for us and has a very peculiar but wonderful methodology, at one point decided he really wanted – we're going to have sort of people talking about cannibalism in culture, where it seems to be in pop culture much more visible these days. So what does that mean? But also about the psychology of our reactions to cannibalism. But he really wanted to have an actual cannibal on the show. And as he said at one point, he was concerned that all the good ones were probably in prison. But we're actually going to have somebody who was famously accused of cannibalism, the so-called New York City cannibal cop, who was accused of plotting, not even cannibalism, of plotting cannibalism. And then,
so on your lunch hour,
I was going to say just after lunch.
Well, can I say one more thing? Tomorrow, please, we're going to do something we don't do that often, which is we do feel like, for all the reasons that just preceded this conversation, that people just need to vent and talk a little bit. So we're going to just not have any guests, and I'm going to take phone calls, and we're going to talk about people's anxieties or lack of anxiety right now about the state of the country.
So that's tomorrow on the Colin McEnroe. Today, cannibals. Tomorrow
just scream,
open phone lines.
Yeah, screaming into your telephone.
You can give us a call if you want to join us, 860-275-7266. Let's talk a couple budgets, and we want to get into what's going on with the state budget in just a second. But I'm wondering, I'll start with Suzanne maybe to get some reactions to the Trump budget that came out yesterday. Of course, much like all budget proposals, the ones that come out from Governor Malloy or the ones that come out from the administration in Washington, they're not really anything other than a plan. And so Donald Trump's plan comes out. It cuts pretty heavily at things like Medicaid. It cuts at a lot of social safety net programs. It has some increases to military spending. There's some stuff that both people on the right and the left don't love so much about this particular budget. Seems to have kind of a big math error in it around how much we're going to make back in terms of economic growth. What do you see in this Donald Trump budget? How do you think it affects us downstream in Connecticut?
I think we're going to see much more conservative budgets coming out in the next couple of years. I mean, look, you've got Republicans in charge of Congress and you've got a Republican president. I think, Donald Trump wants to cut Medicaid. I don't think the cuts will be as deep as he has proposed, but I think there will be cuts. I think that will deeply affect Connecticut, even though we're not as heavily reliant on federal dollars as some states. We're in a position where we're very sensitive to any cuts at all. So,
Paz?
1 in 5 Connecticut residents are covered by Medicaid, and President Trump is proposing a 20% cut to the Children's Health Insurance Program, CHIP. You know, the version in Connecticut is Husky. That would be huge in Connecticut if that went forward. But as you noted at the top of the segment, even with a conservative Congress, a lot of this stuff isn't going to fly. There are conservative Republicans who look at their states and they look at what Medicaid dollars mean to those states. So we'll see. But if any version of this goes forward, it's going to hurt, even in Connecticut. you know, you look at Hartford, where almost 60% of residents are on Medicaid. Waterbury, it's 50%. It would hurt a lot of people in a lot of places in this state.
And I think what Paz says is right, though, Colin. A lot of the pushback is coming actually from people in Congress who are quite worried about what this would mean to their states, including their red states.
Yeah, and a lot of these cuts come to offset $54 billion in new military spending. Raise your hand if you think the American military is too small. Obviously, we can cite every chapter and verse of the way of scaling the size of the U.S. military relative to other militaries across the world. I mean, $54 billion is, once again, not to be weird and paranoid about this, but, he hangs around with all these military dictators, and then he wants $54 billion of new military spending. I don't think these two things are unrelated.
Well, a number of his top advisors are generals at many levels of government, too. And as I've heard said a number of times by commentators over the course of the last couple of days, it's the thing we always love to say, if you're a hammer, everything looks like a nail. And if you're a general, spending on military sounds like a pretty good idea. But that having been said, Colin, probably some downstream effects here in Connecticut. And, we've got our own budget problems to deal with as well.
Right. Well, first of all, the downstream effects in Connecticut. We shouldn't talk about the F-35 with Suzanne here at the table. But, I guess it's sort of, more helicopters, more F-35s. I suppose you can sort of say that that's a quote-unquote good downstream effect. But this is a budget proposal that is very hostile to the poor. I don't know how else you can spin it. If this were to be the budget, which it's not going to be for all the reasons we said, it would be a very it's never a good time to be poor. It'd be an especially bad time to be poor.
I talked about that. The accounting error that's in there. We've often jumped on Tom Foley, who ran for governor twice here, for making some very rosy budget projections about how he was going to climb out of our enormous budget hole in Connecticut without raising any taxes. Trump's budget, Colin, seems to do somewhat of the same thing with a little bit of a trick.
Yeah, it's sort of a logical error. It counts growth two different ways, or counts the same growth twice. Larry Summers is like a weapon that you deploy only in really severe situations. Most of the time you don't want to hear what Larry Summers has to say.
I think I'll agree to that.
Yeah. But Larry Summers has said, among other things, he said, this is a mistake no serious business person would make. It appears to be the most egregious accounting error in a presidential budget in the nearly 40 years that I have been tracking them. So make of that what you will. I'm not a former Treasury Secretary or professor of high finance or anything like that. But
I wonder, Paz, if we might turn to our own budget troubles here in Connecticut for a moment. You've been spending some late nights, including recently at the state capitol. As legislators and the governor try to arrive at some budget deals. First of all, I guess I'll ask, do we have any sort of a union concessions deal struck by the governor?
We have a preliminary deal. The big question is, will the individual unions ratify it? In 2011, it took two tries to get a concession deal accepted by the unions. This is always very difficult. It depends on, the age of the employees, where they are in their career, what they're likely to accept or not accept. There's some pressure in the legislature and in the business community against going forward with the concessions, even though they are crucial to getting through the next 2 years as far as the money Connecticut would save, because there is a fear that if you lock in the state's retiree health and pension programs for another 5 years, because that would be part of the deal, you would extend the basic agreement, that would make further structural changes very difficult to achieve. But my line on that is, anytime a politician has to weigh, today's budget versus tomorrow's possibilities, always bet on what's in front of them today.
I do think it's going to be a lot harder to get, even if the unions agree to the concessions, I still think it's going to be harder to get that package through the legislature, given the makeup that you have. Even though it looks like a good number on paper, the changes that the governor is asking for are not going to stop our cycle of deficits. And I really think that We have to have this long-term view. In fact, my concern is what it does is it perpetuates them and then ties the hands of the legislature and the governor, the next governor, in terms of what they can do to mitigate another deficit. I mean, you're extending a contract out another 5 years. No one else in the country has 30-year contracts. I mean, we do things in this state in a way that no one else does them, and to our detriment, which I think we really need to think about.
I don't have the kind of deep focus on this that Paz and Suzanne have. And first of all, are we still have we seen real full numbers, right? Do we actually have real
full
numbers?
We've seen a PowerPoint presentation. We're a couple of weeks away from having actuarially sound numbers because...
How about the concessions? Do we actually know...
No, that's what I'm talking about, the concessions.
Overview.
Yeah, we have it was literally a PowerPoint that was distributed to legislative leaders and to the press.
And are we still at no layoffs for 5 years? Is that still in there?
4 years.
4 years.
Four years.
I'm inclined to... This is when I get into trouble with the left. Every time I agree with Suzanne about anything. I'm inclined to agree that, I mean, I get nervous about these things. And as Paz says, getting the individual unions to vote in 2011 with, you know, concessions that were mostly putative in nature and, you know, hardly a bitter pill to swallow, but getting compliance or cooperation there was incredibly difficult. This is a somewhat more bitter pill. I don't know whether they're going to get the unions to go along with it. And even if it might not be good news if they do for the exact reasons that both Paz and Suzanne are saying, which, you know, I mean, it really does effectively tie the hands of the legislature and the governor in terms of, you know, further reform. I mean, you're essentially promising the unions that you're not going to do anything else that they don't like for a while.
And the challenge for the union leaders, think strategically. I mean, they know that if they can't deliver this, they're going to have really awful discussions with the next governor, you know, who may or may not be a Republican after the 2018 election. At best, it's going to still be a divided legislature. It may be a Republican legislature after 2018. So the union leaders are looking at the potential for collective bargaining rules to be blown up a la Wisconsin, that kind of thing. Suzanne just smiled.
And rolled my eyes.
Yeah. And...
This would make us look more like Massachusetts and Rhode Island. They keep saying Wisconsin and Mississippi. Small changes to our collective bargaining rules would make us look like Massachusetts. No, I hear this from the union leaders.
I don't even hold Wisconsin out as necessarily the big boogeyman. It's just this is the potential. This is what the union leadership sees. The problem is they have to bring along the rank and file. So it ain't going to be easy, folks.
I just have to ask you, Paz, before we take a break. I mentioned that you were up late. You weren't really up late because we were talking about union concessions. You were up late talking about casinos.
Yeah.
So what's happening? Are we going to get a third casino?
I would not bet a lot on it. It's got to get through the House. It was a very strong vote in the Senate. It was a 2-1 vote in favor of the proposal by the tribes to allow them to jointly develop a casino in East Windsor to compete with MGM. So this was a huge defeat for MGM, which is spending boatloads of money.
Boy, are they.
Yeah.
I mean, you just can't turn on anything without seeing some sort of an ad from one or the other.
They just did a $400,000 buy on TV. You can't open your Twitter feed without seeing their stuff. They claim they're still pushing for a bill that would allow an open competition for a casino, perhaps in Fairfield County, to tap into the New York market. Given that Governor Malloy has all but promised to veto that, the choices in the House really seem to be, do you go along with the tribal plan or do you just do nothing? Do you go with the status quo?
Can we just talk? I just have a couple of quick questions. I'm following this very dimly, but it seemed as though Jepson got an opinion from U.S. Interior this week that took a little bit of the pressure off this question. But I assume that if this thing were to go forward, first of all, MGM would seek injunctive relief right away, and then you're in court, right?
Right. The MGM already has a lawsuit which is on hold because they were premature. But, yeah, basically they said, look, if if this is given to the tribes without competitive bidding or some type of competitive process, it would be a violation of the Equal Protection and Commerce Clauses of the Constitution.
Yeah, what the Attorney General heard from the BIA is essentially that there wouldn't be some of the complications concerning the tribal compact that's already been signed by the state with the two existing tribes. A quick thought, Suzanne, before you
break? Yeah, I think, I mean, look, a no-bid contract is probably not a great idea, which is what we're looking at. I mean, that's what we're looking at. So if the tribes get the no-bid contract off tribal land, that's a precedent that I think, I mean, we're going to end up in court. The state's going to have to defend itself. Do we really want more casinos in the state? They're throwing this out as a way to close the budget gap. We should not be closing the budget gap with, you know, casino money. This is not an effective way.
Perry Zinn-Rowthorn goes on Paz's sleep schedule for about 2 years.
I sure want to quickly get to Michael and Hebron. Hi, Michael. Go ahead quickly.
Yeah, hi. My wife and I are, you know, young, 34-year-olds, just moved to the state from across the country. My wife took a faculty position at UConn, and I don't know how to feel about these proposed union contracts, if it's going to mean more costs and less benefit for my wife in early in her career. How should we feel as new residents with the current state of the financial situation in Connecticut?
First of all, I just want to say, so you're under 40 years old, and you just moved from Oregon to Connecticut. We just want to say thank you. I mean, just thanks, because as we talk about, and thank you for the phone call, as we talk about seemingly every week, Suzanne, you know, we have this out-migration of people. Young people aren't coming here to live. But, of course, Michael's worried. You know, long-term, is this a place that's going to be viable for him to live?
I mean, my fear is that if we do not fix these problems in a meaningful way now, there will be no retirement for your wife when she's ready to retire.
But the professor's going to CBAC anyway? Is this
yes, in UConn, the part of CBAC? Yes, okay, and, okay. And you know, I mean, our pension system is so broke right now that if we do not take drastic measures to shore it up, it won't be there. I really believe that, and I worry about that for our future state employees and our current state employees.
Even with this deal, if it goes forward, your wife still will have very good benefits. The contributions she'll be asked to make to her own retirement and health care will still be a pretty good deal compared to what you see elsewhere.
We're going to take a break. We still got some stuff to tackle from the state capitol this week with Mark Pazniokas from the Connecticut Mirror, Suzanne Bates from the Yankee Institute for Public Policy, and our own Colin McEnroe. I'm John Dankosky, and this is The Wheelhouse. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. We're talking about the week's news, and there's a lot of it once again. We're talking about it with Colin McEnroe, host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR, Suzanne Bates from the Yankee Institute for Public Policy, and Mark Pazniokas, Capitol Bureau Chief at the Connecticut Mirror. I love it when you write this story, Paz. It's not the first story along these lines you've written, but the headline—
Nor will it be the last.
Nor will it be the last. The headline in the Connecticut Mirror today, voting in your employer's interest, no conflict in Connecticut. So just lay out the story for us exactly. Give us maybe an anecdote to help us understand.
This is an issue I periodically revisit when the legislature gives me cause. And Connecticut has very lenient ethics rules. If you are a member of the General Assembly, you can vote on a bill that will benefit your employer. You can vote against a bill that your employer is spending tons of money lobbying against. The only standard in Connecticut is, unless it puts money in your pocket or your spouse's pocket, no problem. There's no language at all in the Connecticut ethics rules about appearances of conflict. I will say there are many legislators who hold themselves to a standard higher than the law, and they do avoid voting on things that affect their employers. John Kissel of Enfield, for example, he's an employee at Eversource, and he stays away from energy legislation because he says it just doesn't look good. The reason I wrote this week is there's a freshman legislator, George Logan, who got up and opposed a drought planning bill that the water industry hates. And George Logan is an employee of the Aquarian Water Company. And in fact, until his election to the Senate, he was their lobbyist. So it was an odd moment. Now, Mr. Logan did not come even close to violating any law. Let's say that. The other person who's in the news in this regard is Joe Arisimowitz, the House Speaker. He is on the payroll of AFSCME, the major public sector employee union, And yet he is at the intersection of all this stuff that's going on and concessions and everything else. Again, Joe Arisimowitz is not close to violating any ethics law. Let's be clear on that. But there's certainly this odd appearance.
And from your story, Paz, I'll just quote, Arisimowitz tells you, I have nothing to do with collective bargaining. He goes on to say, none of my salary is derived from collective bargaining. I can quit my job tomorrow and go sell cars, and it's not going to change the way I feel toward the folks having the right to unionize and collectively bargain in the private sector or the public sector. Suzanne?
When I tell people that our speaker works full-time for AFSCME, people in Connecticut or outside of Connecticut, when people realize that, it's pretty shocking to most people. You're bargaining essentially across the table from yourself. Well, and this is the largest and biggest part of our budget. I mean, the public sector unions have been very good at getting their own people elected in Connecticut. And I remember last year, Gary Winfield, who works for AAUP, which is the Association of University Professors, was heavily lobbying within the Appropriations Committee on a bill that affected UConn employees. And I'm watching him, he votes on this committee. He voted on this resolution on this UConn contract. There are so many conflicts in terms of our public sector union employees in the legislature.
I just want to ask you before I go to Colin here, will you ratify some version of a proposal that we've put out for years here, which is it's a full-time legislature, it's a unicameral legislature, it's more limited, full-timers, no conflicts of interest?
I feel torn about the full-time issue, I'll be honest. I think there are some
very
good reasons
for it. What are they going to do the rest of part-time?
I think
they're going to do something that is conflict of interest?
Absolutely. If they have part-time, they need to have jobs. I'm not even opposed to having a guy from the union elected. I just think he shouldn't be voting on union contracts.
McEnroe-Lebeau proposal is a unicameral legislature of 100 people. They make $75,000 a year. I'm appalled by all the things that Suzanne is appalled by, and I've had the same experience. I would add to that I've also had people from other states express incredible shock back in the day when I would tell them that the minority leader of the House is a partner in one of the most powerful lobbying firms in the state. That was Larry Caffaro. I mean, that's like everything that Suzanne said is true and crazy, but so is that. This is all stuff is just completely crazy. And
he's on the law firm side. Let's just get that.
Yeah, on the law firm side.
But yes, they're major. They also have a major lobbying practice.
Yeah, Brown Rudnick. It's all crazy, and it doesn't even begin to get at the problem of conflict of interest. And to get at that, you'd also have to really understand what recusal means. To me, recusal doesn't mean just not voting. It means not participating in caucus conversations about the bill, all that kind of stuff. And we just don't do it right now. When Chris Morano was the chief state's attorney in Connecticut, I used to say, is corruption illegal in Connecticut? are we against it?
My colleague at the Current, Larry Williams, used to say, you have to be a real idiot to break the law and be corrupt.
Yeah,
because there's so much you can do that's legal.
The bill practically has to name you. It has to be like a bill to give Senator Mark Pasniokas $100,000 for whatever. And then he'd actually go to the Office of State Ethics and they'd go, wow, this is a tough one, but I'm thinking you shouldn't vote on this one.
Here's the thing. But what changes it? I mean, short of a full-time legislature in which you literally remove people's conflict of interest, at least with their employer, that doesn't mean they won't have other conflicts of interest. I mean, how do you change this? Paz, we've had rules on the books. The rules get overturned. The rules change. We have contracting rules that aren't even as strong as they used to be.
Some of it is the culture. There's no discussion about this stuff. What Colin just said about, well, if you're out, you should be out completely. The fact that there is nothing in the Connecticut Code of Ethics about the appearances of conflict, where the state of Rhode Island does have that language, whether it's effective or not, that's a longer show. But the fact that there's nothing in the ethics code that even puts these people on notice, hey, give this some thought about whether you have an appearance of a conflict. It should not be left up to the individual legislators to just sort of make up their own standard.
I want to give a shout out to John McKinney, who's like the only legislator I ever talked to, legislative leader I ever talked to, who really seemed to have a grasp on what this problem was. And I did one time interview him and say, if you don't mean this and you get elected governor and you don't really do it, I will be Marley's ghost. I will show up dragging chains in the governor's mansion. But he really seemed like he kind of got what the problem was.
I think he did.
I think too. I mean, there are a lot of full-time legislatures where there are all kinds of corruption going on and payoffs, and
it's not.
Well, you know, but you know, and then there are part-time legislatures that probably do this better than us. So we probably need to look around and say, what are other states? What are their ethics laws, and what do they look like? I do think this is a part where the media has a really big part to play, and Mark's article was great because I think publicly holding people up and saying, you know, is this right, is such an important question.
Yeah, that's really worked so far.
And I'll write it again next year.
Suzanne Bates from the Yankee Institute, thank you. Mark Bazniokas from the Connecticut Mirror at ctmirror.org. Our own Colin McEnroe, he's talking about cannibalism this afternoon at 1 o'clock.
Also not illegal in Connecticut.
I'm John Dankosky. Thanks so much for joining us in the Wheelhouse.